Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I'm your host, John Orlando, the man that brings you the only nonsensical podcast on the planet that emanates from Providence, Rhode Island, via the capital city of Columbus, Ohio. How are you all doing today as you're listening to episode 84? Man, I gotta be honest, right before I started recording this intro, I was eating lunch. And I thought I'd have a bowl of soup, a little bit cold outside, and I burned my tongue. I haven't done this in forever. God, my tongue feels so weird right now. I thought the soup was cool enough, and I went slurp, and I went, and oh, man, it kills. It really kills. Anyways, but I'm gonna try to muck through this, man. I'm gonna toughen it out, because I gotta do this intro so I can let you know what you're gonna hear on this episode of your favorite podcast, the PVD Cast. Well, I'm happy to have a returning guest. Episode 84 is going to feature Mr. Dar Naragi, who many of you might recall from episode 17 of this very podcast. Dar is a New York Times best-selling author. He wrote a great graphic novel called Persia Blues. There's a second volume to Persia Blues, which he's going to come on and talk about, and he's joined by the man that puts the art, the pictures, if you will, to his words, Brent Bowman. And Brent is a really good guy, too. So I'm happy to have both men that are responsible for Persia Blues Volume 1 and Volume 2, which just came out a couple weeks ago, on this podcast to talk about the creative process and whatnot. So I'm real excited for this episode. I'm going to mention that I know last time I ranted and raved about the WWE TLC pay-per-view and said, well, hopefully the NXT event in London will be better. And guess what, folks? I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet, so I don't know if it's better than TLC pay-per-view or not, but I'm hoping to get to it later this afternoon. But unfortunately, I can't give you my opinions, my thoughts about it, because, well, I still haven't watched it. What can I say? I'm slacking a little bit. I'm slacking. I know. But all right, with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about comics and the creative process of comics with Dara and Brent. But before we get to that, do you need something to read while you're riding the bus home from your job? Are you not interested in long, drawn-out stories that take forever to read? Then, man, do I need to let you know about Disposable Fiction Comics. Jack Wallace and Chris Allen have created the perfect comic book publishing company for those folks who want short, quick tales to read. And read them wherever. If they're on the bus, if they're waiting in line at the grocery store, wherever, man. Look, simply head over to DisposableFictionComics.com to check out their catalog. They even have some samples up on the site so you can preview what they've got. And look, you heard Jack not too long ago on this very podcast talking about Disposable Fiction Comics. I know you're curious, so just head on over to the website, DisposableFictionComics.com, and grab something for the next time you're stuck at the DMV waiting to renew your license. And if you're like, John, I'm not sure how that's spelled, just head over to the link section of this website, pvdcast.com, and there you go. Clickety-clack! You can be right there and grab something to read from Disposable Fiction Comics. Alright, with that being said, let's head to a quick musical interlude, and on the other side of it, you're going to hear my conversation with Brent Bowman and Dar Naragi. Alright, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 84 of the PVD Cast. John Orlando sitting down here with the creators of Persia Blues, Dar Naragi, Brent Bowman. How are you guys doing this evening?
Good.
Yeah, doing good.
All right. Well, let's talk about Volume 2, because Dara, many, many months ago, or maybe it might be even years ago, I don't even know, episode 17, whenever that was.
Long time ago.
In a galaxy far, far away. Which, thank you, by the way, for not going to see Star Wars and coming over to the house to do this. So, it's...
I sold my ticket so I could come and do this.
Oh, well, there you go. It's a first. Anyways, so a long time ago, you came on and talked about Volume 1. So you two guys are back on here because Volume 2 just came out, what, a few weeks ago?
Was it last week?
Last week?
You know, I honestly don't know. I think it came out in bookstores last week, and I think it comes out in comic book stores next week.
Okay, all right. So let's talk a little bit about the Volume 2, if you will. Can you give a brief little summary? Maybe do you want to summarize Volume 1 a little bit and then Volume 2?
Sure.
Okay.
So in Volume 1, we introduced our protagonist, Minu. She's a young Iranian woman. She's a college grad. She's looking to go to, postgraduate work. She wants to come to the U.S., but she's not sure if she can because she's living in Iran at the time. But then there's this whole parallel storyline that's going on with the same character, but it's set in ancient Persia. And she's sort of like a freewheeling adventurer. So part of the mystery that we set up in the first book is how do the two timelines relate to each other? Is it the same character or not? You know, what's going on? And then in the second volume, we kind of explore that a little bit more and drop a little bit more hints as to what may be going on. And maybe some really sharp-eyed readers will be able to pick up some of those clues or, have their own theories. And then by the third volume, we will reveal it all and wrap it all up.
I was going to say, there's a third volume coming, so we don't want to give away too much.
Right.
But I actually don't know what's going to happen next anyway, so...
Well, you know what? Let's talk about the collaboration, because I know that both of you guys are from the panel, which was the collective of comic book artists and whatnot and writers. So, how did you guys... How do I want to phrase this? How was the collaboration between the two of you?
Well, Dara sent me the script just a little bit at a time.
Okay.
So I actually never know what's going to happen next, which I kind of like. Because it sort of keeps me emotionally attached to the characters a little bit. So I kind of... I don't know what's going to happen next. So I'm just as invested in it as the reader is. You know, I help create these characters too.
Sure.
I mean, Dara wrote them, but I kind of made... I just sort of... Pending Dara's approval, I kind of created the look for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel really attached to them. So when something horrible happens to one of the characters, it makes me feel really bad too. So I think that helps me as an artist, though, be able to really capture that emotion, you know, and that like emotional output because I feel emotionally attached to the characters.
And how about you, Dar? How's the collaboration been?
Obviously
successful. I mean, let's be honest. I mean,
it's been awesome. But what Brent was saying about getting the script a bit at a time. It's really not intentional. It's just that I'm working really, really slow, and especially on the second book, I was dealing with a bunch of other stuff, and you know, day job and other life stuff, and it kept me from like sitting down and having like a big chunk of time and actually getting most of the script done. And I didn't want, you know, Brent to just be sitting around because I had already had been pretty late with getting the second volume started anyway. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm just going to start doing, I call them like scenes. So like, you know, a nice chunk at a time and getting it to him. So it just kind of worked out that it worked out for the best because like he was saying, you know, some of that mystery of that the reader would experience, he was experiencing as he was drawing it. So it kind of worked out. But I honestly, if I could have, I really wish I could have gotten like most of the script, if not all of it, done at once, and then he could have read through it all.
If you do that for Volume 3, still just send me a little bit at a time. Because <All right. laughs> I really do like working that way.
All right.
I feel like if I would have the whole thing, it'd be much more clinical and much more... You know, I'd feel like I would be laying everything out in advance instead of making it spur of the moment. I feel like I've got a lot more...
It's more organic just doing it away by getting small pieces? Yeah.
Yeah, because when I have a whole script, you know, I'm going to go ahead and plan everything in advance. And it'll still look cool, but it's not going to be... I don't think there's going to be as much of an emotional kick to it as there would if I'm just kind of, you know, doing it a little bit at a time.
Now, one of the struggles you mentioned with Volume 1, did you letter as well?
Yeah, so both of them. I lettered both, and I know enough to be able to do a decent job, but I'm very slow at it. So on top of, you know, doing the script, and then once the art came back, then it was, you know, I did like a little bit of cleanup and then the lettering, and that would always take me like a good, you know, depending on the complexity of the page, it could take like an hour or maybe even longer per page. I'm not that fast. So yeah, so that added to it.
So Brent, when we're talking about the storyline of the, an ancient adventurer. Mm-hmm. Did you have to do a lot of research to kind of, did Dara fill you in on that?
More than I thought.
Okay. Because,
you know, I know it's ancient Persia, but it's a fantasy version of ancient Persia.
Sure, sure.
So I thought that I'd have, before I started it, I thought I'm going to have a little more freedom to be fantasy based. But once you start getting in there, you really can't do that. I mean, even if you're mixing different eras of Persian mythology, you still have to be pretty accurate. So, you know, in the first volume, I did the very first page is the Columbus skyline as built by the ancient Persians. And that was a lot more complicated than I thought, because I had to look at the Columbus skyline. Mm-hmm. And then I had to kind of find architectural formats from ancient Persia that matched that.
And may I ask, I mean, we're going to dive into your background a little bit, Brent. Do you have a strong, like, background in architecture?
No, not at all.
So it was a struggle then, a little bit,
well,
was
not
it?
Now.
Not really? Not well, now with technology?
A little bit before this, before Persia Blues, I was working on another book with a friend, and it was just a self-published book.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of scenes set in historical places, and so I really had to play around with that, and that's nothing compared to what I did with Persia Blues, but that was kind of my starting point. And at first I just thought it was horrible, and it was a big struggle, but then, you know, by the second or third time I drew a building, I'm like, I really enjoy this. So by the time I got to Persia Blues, I really enjoyed doing backgrounds and buildings.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, Brent. I mean, we'll recap a little bit for you, too. But I'm gonna say, hey, if you're listening and you want to know all about Dar, go back to episode 17. It's in the archives, so just go back. But nonetheless, so Brent, you are a graduate of CCAD?
Yes.
So when did you decide that you were going to pursue art as a career? Like, when you were a kid, were you always sketching
much.
Things?
Yeah, I've been drawing since I was four.
Okay.
That's all the earliest stuff my parents have shown to me. I mean, I didn't think I was ever going to be anything but an artist.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it would have been really awful if I hadn't got accepted in art school, because I didn't have any kind of backup plan at all.
Okay. All right.
I mean, that was the one thing I did really well, that everybody always said, you know, oh, you're a great artist. So I just, you know, I kind of figured that's what I'd do.
In various different facets of art, or just particularly just drawing? Just sketching?
Mostly drawing. Okay. You know, I've tried other things. I like to sculpt, but I'm terrible at it.
Okay.
You know, photography is okay, but again, I mostly utilize it as a reference material for my drawing. So yeah, pretty much drawing is always, drawing and painting a little bit. I don't have time to paint much anymore.
But. Okay. All right. Well, you've had some work that has shown up in Image Comics, Caliber Press as well. You want to talk about those projects a little bit?
Well, the Image project I actually did with Dara.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And, it was one of the...
the Archibald.
Part. Archibald Aardvark. Yeah.
Okay.
It was just a one-page gag strip. And then Caliber was actually a contest winner.
Oh, okay.
So, okay. Yeah, I won the prize for that and got into an issue of Caliber.
Okay.
And I'm sorry. What was the other?
The other thing I was going to mention too. You've had some artwork that's been featured on the card game Age of Empires.
That was actually a subcontractor deal.
Okay.
I just painted them.
Okay.
Yeah, another guy I knew. He did the actual art and then he farmed it out and we painted it. So that was
But that's still got to be
it's
cool.
Still, oh, yeah.
Yeah, to see that. Is that card game kind of more role-playing oriented?
I think so. I never really followed it that much.
Okay.
And from what I understand, my artwork actually has been replaced at some point by others.
What?
I
really?
Think. Well, I went and looked up one of the cards that I did, and I couldn't find my card at all. So I don't know if I just couldn't. Maybe mine was a newer version.
Oh,
and the internet didn't have the...
We'll go with that.
Yeah, that was just kind of more of a... That was just kind of cool, though, because even though I got a lot of the less exciting... cards, you know, they were important. I got like crop rotation and you know.
All right.
So that was it was an interesting project.
Okay.
But I did I'm gonna brag a little bit. I did just actually get accepted into Prehistoric Times magazine.
Yes, I read that. I was gonna ask about that.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Okay. Thanks. What is Prehistoric Times magazine for those that are listening at home?
They're the dinosaur magazine, the dinosaur fan magazine, by dinosaur fans, for dinosaur fans.
Okay.
So, that you know, they have a lot of articles by a lot of really well-known paleontologists. A lot of covers are done by really well-known, like William Stout's done a bunch of their covers.
Okay.
So, you know, it's the magazine that dinosaur people read.
Okay.
So, you know, you're looking at fans, you know, amateur paleontologists, people that love Harryhausen movies, and then also, like, you know, Bob Bakker, and, you know, and all the really big dinosaur guys read that. So I'm just really excited. I'm actually not that great at drawing dinosaurs for some reason, but I love other prehistoric creatures. So it's a giant prehistoric condor.
Okay. What? So is that going to be featured in an upcoming issue?
Yeah, the next issue.
The next issue that's coming out. Okay. Cool. Are you a dinosaur fan yourself?
Yes, I love
dinosaurs. Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah, I've actually been trying to perfect drawing a feathered T-Rex to make it look scary, but you just...
not easy with the feathers.
I was really disappointed in that.
Feathers are somewhat not intimidating. I mean, you know. Right.
I know it's the truth, but it's just not as cool. As
Also, not to jump the gun or anything, but when we are done with the third book of Persia Blues, I've already got another trilogy planned with Brent as the artist.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's going to involve dinosaurs and crop rotation.
Two things you just found out. So. We're gonna the mystery of the crop rotations,
right?
And it leads to dinosaurs.
Exactly.
There we go.
Or it could be like a huge, you know, multi-generational epic, starting with dinosaurs and ending with crop rotations.
Right.
Ooh, there we go.
At which point they dig up a fossil, bringing it full circle.
There we go. So. Look at this brainstorming happening on this podcast as we speak.
Yep.
Done. But, Brent, you're also working on something called Fartoon as well, correct?
Yes.
So tell the folks at home what that's all about.
Well, that's with a writer named Terry Isley.
Okay. Is he local?
He's local.
Okay.
And it's it involves a Somali girl who comes from the refugee camp in Kenya to Columbus. And just it's kind of a slice of life story, you know, just dealing with growing up in a different culture that you don't quite understand. Mm-hmm. You know, so far she's and it's kind of funny because he's also sending it to me in sections like Dara was. Uh-huh. So again, I don't really know how it's gonna end.
Just by happenstance, not by happenstance, plan. Okay. Yeah.
So but yeah, at this point she's been enrolled into a private school based on Columbus School for Girls.
Okay.
And so it's much more, there's no fantasy element to it at all. I like to joke around that what I really loved about Persia Blues was the fantasy element, because I love to draw monsters and people with swords. And what everybody has taken from me drawing Persia Blues is that I'm really good at drawing, you know, young ethnic girls in trouble dramas. And so that's what I'm getting now, which is totally cool. I actually really like that aspect of it, too. But.
So is Fartoon going to be multiple issues, or is it just one issue?
It's going to be a graphic novel.
Okay, it's going to be a graphic novel. Yes. Okay, that was what I was curious about.
Yeah, I'm really proud of the work on it. I think I'm doing some really good work on
it. Yeah, some of the stuff that you had posted on Facebook is very, very clean and very crisp art. So... with that, let's talk a little bit about inspiration from you guys. Dar, what was your inspiration for writing the script for Persia Blues?
Right. It was a couple of things. So when I first thought of it or wanted to do a project like that, it was after I'd done you know, a whole lot of work for hire stuff for like IDW and things like that. So I'd worked on all of these really well-known and recognized properties, and it was a lot of fun, but it wasn't my, you know, it wasn't a character or a concept that I owned, that I was like completely invested in. So I wanted to do something creator-owned, and you know, it sort of made sense when I was thinking about it to try to pull in some of, you know, my background as a Iranian-American, and try to, you know, I wanted to like showcase Persian culture and Persian history and mythology in a positive light, because you either never see it, or you know, if there's anything about Iran, it's usually in the news and it's not good. And if you see anything about, you know, the culture and the history, usually it's through like the lens of Hollywood, and they distort it so much, you know, that it's like almost kind of like a joke. So I wanted to do those things, and then I was sort of, I couldn't decide between like, do I want to do sort of a slice of life, very contemporary, you know, story that deals with the issues going on in the country now, or if I wanted to do it like this complete fantasy story and, you know, showcase all of that stuff. And the more I thought about it, I don't know how that exact idea came about, but I kind of came up with the idea of, oh, wait, I could do both, and this is how I'm going to tie them in together. So that was pretty much the inspiration there. And then, figuring out who I wanted the main character to be, it was like right off the bat, it was pretty clear to me that I wanted to have a female character, because there's a lot more, I think, storytelling potential, especially in the scenes that are set in Iran, because there's a lot of stuff that women have to deal with in that, you know, under that government and that regime that men don't necessarily need to, because of the Islamic laws and all that. So it seemed like a much more rich storytelling venue to explore it with a female character.
And Brett, how about your inspiration for when you started to draw and sketch out things? I mean, you mentioned off air you have a lot of research material in your art studio. Did you draw from that? Did you draw from some of the creators that you admired growing up?
Well, like stylistically, my biggest influences are like the EC comics and like the Warren and the Warren comics, like Creepy and Eerie.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind, I'll tell this story.
Sure, go around. Hey.
So I think it was back in 2010. I was at Mid Ohio Con. I can't remember if it was actually Mid Ohio Con, if it was Wizard World yet. But Gary Kwapitz was there. If you're familiar with Gary Kwapitz, he used to draw Savage Sword of Conan back in the
80s. Okay.
And that was like that was the comic that made me want to do comics.
Okay.
So I went up to his table with my big stack of Savage Sword of Conan to have him sign. And I brought one of my mini comics, and I just, you know, all shyly gave it to him and, you know, said, you know, you're the man that inspired me to be an artist. I just want to let you know that. And he looked at it and he said, oh, that's nice. I said, where are you tabled at? And I showed him and he signed my books. And the next morning he came over to my table before the show opened and he spent about half an hour, 45 minutes with me looking through my stuff.
Oh, wow.
And he just gave me the best portfolio review I've ever had. I mean, he was a little brutal. You know, he's like, yeah, this sucks. This is great. You know, you don't know how to use your blacks was one thing he said. And he asked me why I never use halftones. But then he also gave me a whole bunch of other people to look at. He's like, look at this guy. He actually recommended Jack Tati.
Okay.
And so I went and looked at a lot of the stuff he recommended. And then I started using gray tones in my work. And my biggest influence for the gray tones were the Creepies and Eeries. Because those guys did some amazing, like, ink wash and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen any of the... Alex Toth creepy stuff that he did.
I'm not familiar with some of his creepy stuff. I guess more of his mainstream stuff I'm familiar with, but
the creepy stuff, he had this really great ink wash style that he used.
Mm-hmm.
And then Neil Adams actually had really great, yeah. It was done. There was definitely like some pencil going on in there. So those guys were doing some really unique things with black and white because, you know, partially because it was a black and white magazine, so they couldn't do anything with color.
Mm-hmm.
But also, they were, you know, they were experimenting with black and white. So, you know, you'd have pencil, you'd have graphite, you'd have ink washes. And so I really looked at a lot of that. And I wouldn't say that there's any one particular person that inspired me, but it's just a lot of the different Eerie stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, just playing around with the texture. In the first volume, there's I used some charcoal for some of the nature scenes. So I try to go organic with the, you know, with the actual organic elements in the art, like trees and bushes and, you know, skin and dirt and rocks. You know, I try to use mostly the pencil. You know, for the rougher textures, I'll use a rougher pencil.
Okay.
And then for the smoother textures, I try to use my my gray tone markers to kind of smooth it out. And I've got a blender marker that I use on some of the graphite. For like rock textures where it's rough but also smooth, I kind of use the blender marker to keep it more like rocky texture.
All right.
And I got a lot of those ideas from the creepies and the Eeries.
Well, you are a big comic book fan.
Yeah.
I know that from doing some research here. So who were some of your favorite comics, favorite superheroes that you read as a kid?
When I was about 10, I think, my uncle gave me a big box of Marvel and DC comics.
Okay.
And... So, oddly enough, I mean, I still have all my favorite ones, the first three I read. I've replaced them through the years at cons because they got all torn up.
Sure.
one was a Tigra, and there was a Ghost Rider and an Invaders issue. I still remember those really clearly.
Okay.
And then the Superman families, I don't know, those, I really loved them, but I wouldn't say they really inspired me much.
Okay. But you just enjoyed reading them.
Yeah,
you enjoyed the tales of Superman. Okay.
But I mean, I was like everybody else, John Byrne X-Men, you know.
Sure.
Everybody's drawing John Byrne X-Men.
Uh-huh.
I remember Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when that came out when I was in junior high school. And I still have my volume one. But it's hard to pick one particular book that inspired me, but How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way was like my gateway to...
Oh, I have that in my... It's a very popular book in my classroom. Kids like it. But yes, I have one of them. Because I think there's a couple different volumes, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe they're reprints.
They may have reprinted them.
Yeah, because I have one that's in there. It's very, very, very popular.
He was just awesome. John Buscema. I have to say, I didn't realize it at the time, but if I had to pick a comics artist that influenced me more than anybody else, mm-hmm. it would be John Buscema.
So, let's talk just a little bit about just comics in general.
Oh, sure.
Okay, what comics do you... Are you still reading comics now?
I get a lot of my comics at the library now.
Okay.
Just financially, it's much harder to buy comics.
Sure. Oh, so that's a whole podcast in itself. Let me just tell you right there. But what do you enjoy reading?
Everything.
Really?
Everything...
From superheroes to westerns to whatever, you know, genres, or...
It's harder for me to get into the superheroes now, because I was away from it for a while, so it's really hard to catch up. And then I also get a little depressed, because it just seems there's a lot of the fun has gone out of it, you know, the sense of wonder. You know, I mean, you see...
Is it because you're getting older, or because of constant reboots?
I feel like it's because they don't... I kind of like the idea of all-age comics.
Okay.
And I understand it's great that there are adult comics, but I feel like there's no comics for kids anymore. You know, I mean, you've got the Falcon as Captain America sleeping with an underage girl who turns out to actually be, what is it, some kind of, she's really old, but she's trapped in a young body or something like that.
I must confess, I have no idea about that.
Oh, no,
that sounds preposterous. I just saw ridiculous.
It on like one of the comic book websites on my Facebook feed. But
okay,
it just seems like they're so nobody's going after the kids or the young people, and that's what I grew up with comics. So you know, I don't know. I felt like I could just pick up a Superman Family, which is definitely for kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you read a Spider-Man, which is, you know, the early Spider-Man, which was made for adolescents.
Yeah, and you know what? I think I never actually really thought of it that way. I really didn't. Because my foray into comics was toy-driven. G.I. Joe toys, so I got the G.I. Joe books. But the books always, to me, seemed to be a little more adult than me, because people died, and there were arguments, and... there were new characters that there weren't toys for, and to me, I gravitated towards that in that particular book more so than the cartoon. Like I would watch the cartoon, but I didn't like it. To me, it was go to the spinner rack and get another issue that Larry Hama wrote, and you know, come home and just be engulfed in it, and then you know whatnot. So, but I guess I never really thought of it that way. Nowadays, it doesn't seem like
there's not that many. You know, when they do come out, it seems like the companies don't want to publicize it or don't want to...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good
was
point.
Was it Paul Pope? Was that Paul Pope recently that had that wanted to do the all-age comics and they... Was it Marvel or DC?
Oh, I remember the story. Yeah, the story? I don't remember the details, but yeah, it was all over Facebook because people were linking to the article. He had pitched a... it was a Marvel character and he had pitched a story and they basically said no. Because it, you know, it's for kids and they don't buy comics or something along those lines.
That's unfortunate.
And this is a big name like Paul Pope saying, "Hey, I want to do this." So
yeah. Well, since we're talking about publishers, let's talk about your publisher, MGM. Sure. How's the relationship been with those guys?
It's been good. You know, I think the best part of it is they pretty much said, you know, once they approved the book and there, you know, we went back and forth a little bit in terms of like tweaking the plot a little bit, but for the most part it was, you know, pretty much what I pitched them. But mm-hmm. once they approved it, they've been very hands off, you know.
Yeah,
when we did the first volume, and honestly, I mean, we're not even going through like layers of editors or whatever, we're dealing straight with the publisher, Terry Nantier.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to see Brent's pencils before I went to ink, and all of that, which, you know, is fairly standard. It made it a little bit harder for us just because there was such a volume of work to do and we were kind of crunched for time. But, you know, there really weren't that many changes where he's mm-hmm. like, no, you know, do this over or do this other thing or I don't like this. And in terms of the story and the script, there was minor, you know, notes. So in that respect, it's been awesome because I sort of feel like it's us, you know, the work really is us and what we want to do. But we also sort of have like this safety net of, there is somebody there to also look at it. Like, it's not a completely self-published book where, you know, we may miss some big thing because we didn't have an editor. So, in that respect, it's been good.
Right. And just to fill you in, NBM, for those folks that are unfamiliar, a big publisher, especially in Europe and Canada. They may not do many books in the United States, but they certainly do push out a lot of different graphic novels over in Europe and Canada, and they're stationed in New York City, correct?
Yeah, they're in New York. They've been around since the 70s. They're probably one of the first publishers in the U.S. to just publish graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, you know, they've done a big mix. They do a lot of European reprints for the U.S. market. They do some new stuff here. But then they also have a couple of other imprints. One of them is called Paper Cuts, and they do a lot of licensed properties for kids.
Oh.
So they do
Nancy Drew and
Hardy Boys is one of the licensed.
Yeah, they did the Tales from the Crypt a few years back.
Okay.
The new Tales from the Crypt.
So you know, it's they're pretty diverse. They even have another imprint called Erotica, which is like erotic comics, mostly European. They pretty
mostly
much cover
European. Okay. Yeah,
they cover the bases.
Not that people in America wouldn't appreciate an erotic comic.
Right.
But...
And speaking of the panel connection here, there was an artist in panel who's actually one of the founding members, and he did his own porn graphic novel through NBM's imprint.
All right.
So there's that connection back to Columbus. But yeah, you know, they're...
Well, you got to meet with Terry and Sven, right, when they were in town.
Yeah, that was kind of nice. Was it
all business, or was it a little business and pleasure, or was it all pleasure, so to speak?
I would say it was mostly pleasure. Yeah. There was some business, but yeah. I think it was mostly pleasure.
Yeah, and I, you know, neither one of us knew that they were going to be in town, and like Terry told me that the night before, he's like, "Oh, by the way, I'm going to be in Columbus for there's like a school librarian convention."
Mm-hmm.
And they had a booth there to basically promote their books. And he's like, you know, if you and Brent are free, let me take you out to dinner. And so it was very last minute. But yeah, we had a really nice dinner. We ended up like talking for 3 hours. And I think the waiters at that point were like, could you guys just get up and leave? But we were ordering drinks, so they're okay.
They've just got a lot of good stories. You know, I mean, they've been around forever.
Sure.
So they know they've met all these really famous people. And, you know, but... To them, they weren't famous people. I guess they were just clients or people they knew, you know? So that's really interesting perspective, and it's really cool to hear all those stories.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the accolades that Persian Blues got, obviously Volume 1, but it was deemed as a nominee for Great Graphic Novels for Teens in 2014 by YALSA, YALSA, I believe is a...
Young Adult Library Services Association.
Yeah, yeah. 2014 recommended feminist literature for Birth to 18 by Amelia Bloomer Project. May I just say, Birth to 18? That's a big chunk of years there. I'm curious about why they went that way.
We have a lot of babies that love
it. a lot of babies that enjoy having that read to them. Yeah. All right. Also got rave reviews from Comic Book Resources, Publishers Weekly. Broken Frontier, which I think is a blog, correct?
I think they're like a blog like slash news site.
News site.
Yeah.
So lots of rave reviews for there. So what did you guys think about when the reviews started pouring in for Volume 1?
I was pretty excited to get the Young Adult Library Association award.
Yeah,
I was
right.
Like, because like all my favorite authors have been on that list at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's just... Mm-hmm. I have been on a list, not, we didn't win, but I've been on that nomination list along with Terry Pratchett and J.K. Rowling, and you know,
yeah,
that's just cool to me to have been on a list that they were on.
Oh, and of course the Space Prize, I kind of overlooked that, but that also a very prestigious award.
That was really exciting, because that's my favorite convention to go to, is Space, and mm-hmm. so, you know, to be honored by, I mean, because... I don't know. To be honored by that group of people, to me, is a really big deal. I'm really, really proud of that one.
Yeah, that's really cool, because especially, you know, if people don't know about Space, it's a convention in Columbus in the spring, and Space stands for Small Press and Alternative Comics Expo. And I think, I've lost track, but I think this upcoming year will be like their 14th or 15th year.
I think so.
Yeah.
A local guy, Bob Corby, puts it together. You know, he started it. He still runs it. And it's just all, you know, people that are doing self-published comics, zines, alternative comics. And the Space Prize gets voted on by the folks that are exhibitors at the show. And then a panel, I think, of three judges that Bob, you know, rotates every year. So, yeah. So, like Brent was saying, I mean, it's really cool because it's like folks that we've been seeing, and we've been reading their work, and and vice versa, and we've been tabling there for like the longest time. So that was awesome. The, you know, the Library Association stuff was really cool. It was interesting because when I was writing the script and when I came up with the story and everything, I didn't necessarily conceive of it as a young adult book per se, but at the same time, I didn't want it to be a overtly adult book either.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, especially on that first issue, since it was kind of like new territory, you know, we would get to like some scenes where there'd be a battle scene or something, and I would have to think about it, and I would tell Brent, I'm like, oh, okay, so let's, I mean, it's a battle scene, and we obviously kind of want to, you know, portray the idea that, I mean, this is war, and this is not a nice thing, but I also don't want to make it too gruesome or gory or whatever. And I wasn't, like, necessarily thinking that, oh, because I want the book to have, like, such and such rating or whatever.
Yeah.
It just didn't seem like it was necessary. So then, like, when we started getting all of these, like, reviews and stuff from young adult blogs or, you know, the nomination, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I never really thought of it that way, but...
Yeah.
It is a book that can be enjoyed by, you know, most folks, probably not like younger readers, but, you know, certainly like high school kids and above, and
mm-hmm.
definitely grown up. So it's kind of nice, you know, and it's helped me with like the second book, because now I have this idea of, oh yeah, that worked, and or maybe this thing didn't work, and I can be a little bit more focused.
Let's talk about the most unusual review that you got. It was on YouTube. It was, if I remember correctly, called a book's review.
Oh, yeah.
Alistair Book.
Yeah, that was...
Do you want to kind of describe this? Because honestly, folks, if you're listening, you just have to go to YouTube and check this out. Because I'm not quite sure if a verbal representation of this can do it justice. But do you guys want to talk about it?
All right. So, yeah, I'll give it a shot. So since the book just came out, I was Googling it just to see, you know, who's picked up on it.
Hey.
Is anyone running the press release? You know, are there any reviews out there?
Sure. We all have Googled ourselves.
Exactly.
I mean, let's be honest. You know?
Right. So that's how I came across it. And it was called like A Books Review or something like that. And the A has a period after it. So I go to the website and it's actually a book. And I had to look over on the right-hand side where the, you know, guy that runs the blog has, like, a little bit about himself. And there's, like, very little information. I have no idea who this guy is. But he basically said this blog is a way for him to be able to indulge, you know, several of his passions, one of which is making puppets, and the other one is comics and graphic novels. So there's, like, it's sort of like a puppet book, and he's sitting on a chair next to a fireplace, and he talks in this distinguished British accent, and he does book reviews.
It's like Masterpiece Theater.
Yeah,
sort of, but not.
I thought it was really, really cool.
So it's certainly the most unique thing I've ever seen, and I'm like, wow, all right. So, yeah, Alistair Book reviewed our book.
There you go. A Books Review. Definitely YouTube it. It's interesting. And it's not very long. It's not like,
it's
what,
short,
3 minutes or something like that? So
it's more of a summary than a review. There's like a little bit of a...
Okay.
But yeah.
Who would have thunk? All right. You know what? Probably this question predominantly obviously goes to you. Have you received any feedback from fellow Iranian-Americans, Persians?
Mm-hmm. You know, not that much. A couple of emails sort of out of the blue just from the website, because we have, you know, contact information.
Sure,
out there.
Yeah.
The one, actually, I got an email from a guy in Iran, and he wanted to know if the book would be for sale there. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. And then he asked me if there's any way that there's going to be like a Persian translation of it at some point. And
okay.
I said, again, not officially, but, you know, if somebody out there wants to take it upon themselves to do it, you know, I'm okay with that. Maybe our publisher won't be okay with it, but I'm okay with it.
Did that worry you a little bit when you go, ah, yeah, it's probably not going to be offered?
Right.
And, like, were you worried you're on a watch list now over in Iran? This guy writes books about our culture.
That's the thing, you know, like, not specifically with that particular email, but in general, it's sort of a little bit of a worry in the back of my mind.
Really?
Because,
okay.
Just because it's so hard to tell. Like, I think, you know, obviously there's elements in the book that's critical of, like, the way that the government is there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a small part of the book. It's not,
sure.
You know, it's not a political book. It's a small part of it. And at the same time, it's a small book. It's not like a, you know, million selling worldwide, whatever. But there's still this part of me in the back of my mind that I'm like, I don't know, like, is it going to cause problems down the road? Because, I mean, I haven't been back in quite a few years, like 9 years, 10 years. But if I wanted to go again, you know, I don't know. And my, you know, my parents, my dad goes back like every other year or whatever, and it's obviously not a big deal to them. But it, sometimes I wonder about it. And I did get like, I got an interview request from a journalist with like Radio Free Iran, I think. And it's a very, very political anti-government, you know, they, and I think they're based in Europe somewhere. And I had to decline because I said, you know, honestly, I don't know how it's going to affect my family that lives there. And at the same time, I don't really want to politicize that part of the book because that's not really what it's about.
You know? Yeah, sure. So, sure. Yeah. All right, with that, let's ask, what future hopes do you have for the story? In terms of, like, if you got the offer, make a film or a television project, would you be all right with that? Would you do...
I want Ron Perlman to be in it. That's just...
Ron Perlman must be in it. Okay.
Ron Perlman will be Ahriman, the evil god.
Okay, all right.
Because Ron Perlman is awesome.
Yep. The other funny thing is, totally independent of each other, we had thought about like a director that could do a good job, and we both came up with the same guy.
Yeah, completely at random.
And that would be
Tarsim.
Yeah. Oh,
can
okay.
I say that? Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
We tried to get a copy of the book to him, but the talent agency returned it.
Really?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah, they're like, no unsolicited material.
Now, Tarsim, if I remember correctly, he did that very unusual, like, animated movie, Nine? Is that?
No, you're thinking of a different guy. Tarsim did I think his first, like, big movie was the Jennifer Lopez movie, The Cell.
Oh, okay.
Which is,
okay,
just
okay,
for the record, is a terrible, terrible movie, but yeah, so beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. It's the visual thing. But okay, the movie of his that I saw that I was totally blown away, just the content and the visual look of it, was called The Fall. And it was like this small independent movie, but he, for the most part, made it, I think, with a lot of his own money. But what he did was, because he does a lot of commercials, he directs a lot of commercials and he travels all over the world. So what he would do is, when he was in a part of the world where there's some like amazing scenery or structure or something that he wanted to use in his movie, he would essentially use the fact that he's being paid to film a commercial there. And then he would call his actors in and they would have a few days and then it would film like a scene.
Really?
So it took him like, I don't know, 10 or 12 years to make this movie.
Really?
But it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really good. I mean, it's just a great story. And it's kind of oddly alike Persia Blues in a way, because it's two different. Yeah. It's got a fantasy setting and then a real world setting.
Well, yeah, there we go. I'm going to have to put that on my to-watch list.
Yeah.
Right. It's really good.
The Fall.
It's
really okay.
You know, he got famous. He's actually, his big key to stardom was the Losing My Religion video for R.E.M.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was that guy. Okay,
yeah,
I remember
he's
that
got
video.
That style. When he did that, the Greek mythology movie, you know, where he did the same thing. You know, every scene is actually set up to look like a Renaissance painting.
Huh.
So he's got that really beautiful technique, and I think it would be, I think Persia Blues would look awesome. Like,
and then when I was reading up about him, like after I saw The Fall, I just wanted to read and know a little bit about him. Apparently, his dad was a pilot, and he's Indian, so his last name is Singh. And I think when he was a kid, like his dad, one of his routes was to Iran, to like Tehran. I think he has been in Iran or lived there for a while too.
Oh.
So in the back of my mind, I'm like, shh. It's like every
slam dunk.
Every sign that the universe is sending us is, this is the dude.
But if it wasn't for those stupid secretaries at the talent agency,
I know,
send them back the book.
I know, we got to figure out how to get to them.
There's got to be a way to get. Now, we've had that problem with. I mean, because you sent it to a couple other people, didn't you? Too.
Yeah,
did
I just
you?
Sent it to a couple.
Just people name that drop. It doesn't matter. Go ahead.
I honestly can't tell you because it was 2 years ago. I know I sent it to another person, and it was more of a. Like, it was just someone that I liked, and I'm like, hey, you know, this is a book I'm really proud of. I want you to take a look at it. And it came back. Same deal.
Man!
What I was disappointed with, the last, because I don't do a lot of mainstream shows anymore, mm-hmm. just because they're just too expensive.
Sure.
And you don't make enough money doing them.
Yes.
But I did get comped at Wizardworld a couple years ago,
mm-hmm.
so I was all excited, because I hadn't been in a while. And, I remember back in the good old day. I'm doing air quotes.
I do it all the time. That's okay. My listeners are used to it.
So, you know, in the good old days, you could go to the show and the celebrities would be out walking around. mm-hmm. and you could interact with them. And I hadn't been into a mainstream show in such a long time that I had no idea they were completely sequestered now, you know. So I was all excited. I thought, well, this will be a good way to get, because I'm really close to Shannon Doherty's booth. And so I thought, you know, I could get this into her hand somehow. But yeah, they don't even let you near the celebrities anymore.
Were you a big fan of 90210?
No.
Oh, you just wanted...
No, she was the closest
celebrity. You were the closest one. You're like, I'm going to talk to her. She was the closest celebrity's
booth, yeah. All right.
I just had to ask.
That one, because that was the one I could see from my table. Well, I would have been able to see it from my table if there weren't the big giant barricades blocking the celebrity section from everything else.
Right. Yeah, that's unfortunate.
So, but, you know, going back to your original question about it... you know, if it happens, that's great. It's like the last thing on my mind in terms of like even thinking about it.
Well, I just asked because that's the hot property. I mean, comic books and graphic novels, the hot property, as everybody knows.
True.
I mean, whether you're talking about The Flash or Arrow or big screen movies, you know, obviously, you know, the Avengers with their success and Ant-Man and everything else Marvel's put out here recently. I just thought we'd see what your idea would be. I figured you'd be A-okay with it.
Oh, yeah. We'd totally be okay with it. The thing that's working against it is, I mean, aside from the fact that it's like a small indie book that probably most people don't know about, is it would be a very difficult thing to, like, translate to film because it would be super-duper expensive. Like, I don't see how you could do it on the cheap, you know, just because of the settings, you know? Like,
you're just saying you need $40 million in order to make the film.
I don't think that would cut it. I'm thinking at least $100 million.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay.
No, but you know, it really would be a difficult thing to like film.
Yeah.
And I'm not even experienced in that field, but like I'm like, wow. I think it would work great as a TV series because mm-hmm. when I first conceived of the story, I had more of I did pitch it to Vertigo actually. Because I had this idea of like wanting to do a long, long monthly book, but mm-hmm. that still had like an ending, and you know. So when I put the proposal together, it was a story, and it had the summary. You know, obviously had the beginning, and the middle, and the end of the story. But there's a lot built in there for you know expanding it depending on how it was received and all that kind of stuff. And even as a graphic novel, I mean, it's going to be over 300 pages by the time we're done with the third volume. There's a lot of material there, and it would work beautifully, I think, as a weekly serial because you can like dole out little pieces of the mystery mm-hmm. as you go along, and then build up on all the characters. But you know, it's like I said, it's just such a. I think it would be such an expensive thing to do that it's never going to happen. But
so, when are you going to start working on Volume 3?
I told myself after the holiday, so once I get over the hump of all this craziness,
and that's your own personal deadline. It's not from your publisher.
Yeah, okay. And you know, maybe that's part of the problem is that they were not very strict with us in terms of deadlines. So the second book got delayed. Honestly, though, I mean, one of the big reasons for the second book being starting it so late was when I was working on the first book and you know, finish it and everything, my mom was sick. She had cancer and, you know, it was a really, really difficult time. And then, like, you know, shortly after the first book came out, she passed away. And after that, I mean, it was like the last thing I wanted to do was sit down and write anything, like mm-hmm. let alone this book, because a lot of the stuff in this book, I mean, there's a part of the storyline and, you know, we allude to it in the first book. So you kind of can guess what's going to happen. And then we show it in the second book is the fact that Minu's mom has cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was writing that, like when I came up with that idea and I was like, that was part of the storyline. My mom's illness hadn't happened, so it's not like I'd based it on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so then given, like, how things worked out in life, it was really hard. Like, I did not want to go back and revisit this stuff at all. And I tried a few times, and I would, like, you know, write 5 or 6 pages, and it was just total crap, and I would, like, delete it. And I finally, you know, emailed our publisher, and I'm like, look, this is what's going on in my life, and I'm having a really hard time with this book. It's already late. It's going to be late. You know, what can we do? And he basically said, you know, just deal with your life. And then once you're at a place where you can come back to it, let me know. Like, he didn't, there was no like, oh, you signed a contract. You've got to deliver it by mm-hmm. X and Y date or whatever. There's none of that, which was honestly, was really cool. Like, I was surprised.
And refreshing. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
Wasn't there, if I may too, wasn't there another issue with Superstorm Sandy? and their offices, or was that volume one that occurred?
That was, because I'm trying to think. I
remember you telling me a story that Superstorm Sandy had hit and devastated, obviously, most of New Jersey and New York, and their offices were really shut down for like 2 or 3 weeks. Was that?
Yeah, they didn't have like internet access or phone access for like 2 weeks, and he would. And I can't remember like the chronology of it, like at what point in the production of the first book, if it was
Wilder. It was the first book then? Okay.
It was the first book. Okay. I think it was right after the first book had come out.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, there's times where like I would email him and I wouldn't hear anything back. And then like 3 days later, I get an email and he's like, yeah, I'm at a McDonald's stealing their Wi-Fi because we still don't have working internet at the office and it's really spotty at home. And yeah, so.
All right. Well, we're getting up to about 50 minutes, so we'll start winding things down. Do you guys have some final words that you'd like to say to the folks listening at home? Besides maybe buy the book. I mean, those three words, I'm sure.
Am I allowed to say you can get it? It's in the public library?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
Okay. Because I know we want you to buy the book, but I'm just also really excited if you read it. So it is in the public library in Columbus, probably all over the place, because it did get a Young Adult Library Association nomination.
There you go.
And here's a plug. If you don't see it in your library, ask your library to get.
There you go. And is this available on Amazon?
It's on Amazon. You can get it for the Kindle. You can get it for the Nook. You can buy it at any bookstore can get it for you. You can get it at a comic book store. So it's
you can even buy it at Westfield Comics, by the way.
There you go.
I saw it on the order form like a couple of months ago. Awesome. Which is always why it screws up. I love Westfield. But it always screws up my timeline because I can never keep. Oh, that was solicited a couple months ago. Is it coming up this week? Next week? 2 weeks from now? Like, I'm always. Yeah. My brain's always scrambled. All right. How about social media? Where can folks get in touch with you if they want to? If they want to shoot a tweet or post or email or whatnot?
So I'm a Luddite. I'm not on Twitter.
Okay.
But we have a website for the book called PersiaBlues.com. And you can also contact us through there. There's a contact form. There's previews. There's links to the previous podcast. There'll be a link to this podcast.
Oh, thank you.
The reviews and assorted other press material about the book. There's all sorts of stuff on the website. So
we probably should have a Facebook page, shouldn't we?
We probably should. I've been thinking about it. It's just one of those things where it's like you always think about it and you're like, okay, I just need to set aside some time to do it. And then you never find the time to do it. But yeah, so that would be the next thing. Get a Facebook page set up for it.
Yourself, Brent? Any social media?
I just Facebook. That's all I do.
Okay.
I don't understand Twitter, and I don't want to. I mean, you always see people getting in trouble for something that they tweeted, and I just don't want that in my life. So,
well, knock on wood, I have yet to do that. So we'll try to avoid some of those. All right, so just look you up on Facebook if you're interested.
Yeah, I mean, on the PersiaBlues.com website, it has links to my art
page. Well, there you go.
So, yeah, I've got several different art websites for my illustration and for my comics.
All right, so there you go. PersiaBlues.com is your one-stop shop.
Exactly.
For everything that you need to know about these two gentlemen.
We even have links from there to, like, all the various places you can buy the books. So.
There you go. There you have it. All right. Hey, well, guys, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having us.
All right. With that, I'm going to take a very quick break. And on the other side of this break, I will wrap up this episode. So stick around. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Dara Naragi and Brent Bowman, the guys behind Persia Blues, Volume 1 and 2. As I mentioned, Volume 2, subtitled Love and War, has just come out. So, man, just go to your local comic book store, see if you can grab the graphic novel, jump on Amazon and order it, or whatever. Wherever you get your graphic novels, wherever you get your books, definitely check it out. I'm sure that they will have Persia Blues, Volume 2. From NBM Publishing. And if you want to check anything out in regards to Dara or Brent, the easiest way to do it is just go to PersiaBlues.com. All of their contact information, all of their background, all of their information about the book even is available right there. PersiaBlues.com. One more time, that's PersiaBlues.com. Definitely head on over there and check it out. Well, it's time for me to tell you about something else I want you to check out. Oh yeah, that's right. It's time for Orlando's Fave. That's right. It's time
right now for me to tell you about something I think is cool, something that I think you should check out, something that is noteworthy. And quite frankly, I kind of already mentioned what it is I'd like you to check out, what the fave is, and that is Amazon.com. Now, in particular, I want to talk about their customer service. Because, you know, over the last couple of weeks, I've had a couple of run-ins with some other companies that have had really piss-poor customer service. I'm just going to say it. And I'm not even going to go off on a tangent and rant about that. What has happened, though, over this last week was I ordered some Christmas gifts from Amazon. And I was told that they shipped. And then I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. So I checked the order. And lo and behold, these two orders were combined into one box. And that box was delivered to my house on a Wednesday evening. And I was home. I never got them. I never got the shipment. And so when I realized this, I quickly figured out a way in which to contact Amazon, which they made it very easy. They were like, if you want to email, that's fine, or live chat, or we can call you. I chose for them to call me. And lo and behold, I explained what the situation was and said, hey, you know, I didn't get this particular box. I didn't, you know, you combined the two orders. And the customer service was phenomenal. No hoops to jump through. No third degree, no long giant diatribe about why didn't it come or anything like that. The young lady just said, okay, that's all right. We will reorder both of these items. We will ship them to you via two-day delivery, free of charge, no questions asked. And so therefore, I want to say Amazon.com's customer service, phenomenal. They are my fave for this week because, I mean, again, they deserve it. They deserve to get a little, hey, good job, attaboy, whatever you want to call it, some congrats, some props, whatevs, for doing what every company should do. All right, well, let's talk about another company that has great customer service, and I know firsthand. That is Bluehost.com, which is the official web hosting service for the PVDcast. Bluehost offers great customer service and competitive pricing. Look, I've said many times, there's been a few glitches that I've had with PVDcast.com. A simple call or online chat, and the Bluehost tech, bam, knocked it out, fixed the problem right away, no questions asked. And man, oh man, I'm impressed with the service that I've had, with the experience that I've had using Bluehost.com. Right now, they have slashed prices again. You got to get over to Bluehost.com to check out that pricing. I mean, let's be honest, you've always wanted your own website. Now's the time. Head on over to Bluehost.com to get all the information. All right, ladies and gentlemen, with that being said, let's talk about where you can get in touch with me. Of course, I'm on Twitter at PVDMVP. That's also the same username for my Instagram account. And if you want to shoot me an email, feel free to do so. JohnOrlando@PVDcast.com is how you can do that. So, I don't think there's anything else I really need to discuss. I think I'm going to close up shop. So, I want to thank each and every one of you for listening to me, and I will chat at each and every one of you later!